Timothy chapter 5, where Paul was beginning his instructions, or expanding on his instructions to Timothy on how to deal with certain people within the church, certain groups of people within the congregation. And last time, verses 1 through 2, we looked at his instructions basically to all people within the congregation. And now he turns to a specific group, and that is widows. Now, too often this particular passage gets turned into a social gospel. It's not a social gospel. If anything, it highlights and emphasizes the biblical roles that God is very clear about, the distinct roles between men and women that God has ordained from the foundation of the world. And that is a message today that is absolutely, totally rejected by the vast majority of our culture today, that there should be any distinction between men and women in terms of roles and within the culture and within the home and church and family. So this is not a social gospel, but the Bible is very clear about the distinct roles that God has ordained for men and women. We saw this over in chapter 2 in verses 9 through 15. We see it in 1 Peter 3, where the husbands are to treat their wives as a weaker vessel. Let me just go ahead and read verses 3 through 16. We're not going to get through all those today. We'll get through verse 7. But just to get the flow of it. Honor widows who are widows indeed, but if any widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to practice piety in regard to their own family and to make some return to their parents, for this is acceptable in the sight of God. Now she who is a widow indeed and who has been left alone has fixed her hope on God and continues in entreaties and prayers night and day. But she who gives herself to wanton pleasure is dead even while she lives. Prescribe these things as well, so that they may be above reproach. But if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he is denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. Let a widow be put on the list only if she is not less than 60 years old, having been the wife of one man, having a reputation for good works, and if she has brought up children, if she has shown hospitality to strangers, if she has washed the saints' feet, if she has assisted those in distress, and if she has devoted herself to every good work. But refuse to put younger widows on the list, for when they feel sensual desires in disregard of Christ, they want to get married, thus incurring condemnation, because they have set aside their previous pledge. And at the same time, they also learn to be idle, as they go around from house to house, and not merely idle, but also gossips and busybodies, talking about things not proper to mention. Therefore, I want younger widows to get married, bear children, keep house, and give the enemy no occasion for reproach, for some have already turned aside to follow Satan. If any woman who is a believer has dependent widows, let her assist them, and let not the church be burdened, so that it may assist those who are widows indeed. So Paul's instructions here to Timothy concerning the care of the widows really is just emphasizing, again, the high view that the Bible places on women. Yes, there's a distinction in roles, but that doesn't mean there's a lesser value placed on women. If anything, the Bible gives and teaches a high value of women and a high view of women into how to be treated. Women are to be the objects of special care within the Bible. They're to be protected, they're to be cared for, they're to be nurtured, they're to be protected and by the male and provided for both physically and spiritually. And as a result, the wife then serves the one who serves her. Remember, husbands are to treat their wives, to live for their wives, as Christ did the church and gave himself up for. So there's a servant role there. And so the wife serves the one who serves her. Women, biblically, are never intended to support themselves, much less a husband and a family to be the sole breadwinner. Yes, there can sometimes be exceptions. Sometimes women, oftentimes, especially in agrarian society, they would work alongside their husbands. But it was the husband who shouldered the primary responsibility and for the caring and the providing and the protecting. You have Priscilla who worked with Aquila. They were both tent makers, but they were side by side. You had Lydia who was a seller of purple fabric. But she may have been a single woman. So Paul's instructions assume and uphold the divine design. This need to care for widows is not because it's some sort of fallout from a society that's oppressive to women. Rather, it reflects a high view of women. Notice that the instructions that Paul gives here are for widows, not widowers, not men. Men are always expected to provide for themselves and to support themselves and their families. You know, it's kind of sad when we look at our culture today. And there's so much talk, so much pride, so much boisterous bragging, talking about all the advances that women have made in the 20th, 21st century, the barriers they have broken down, the ground that's been gained, the doors that are open to them now, the independence that they have. In fact, they've become so independent that more and more people are delaying marriage later and later and later in life to pursue a career. And even once after marriage, and children come along, that career is still often pursued. And the children get shoved over into a daycare, or over into a corner somewhere. Personally, I don't see the advances. To me, it seems women are less honored today in our culture. They're less valued. They're less treasured. Women in the work are often seen today as a competitor in the workforce instead of a helpmate to the husband. Who still stands up today when a woman walks in the room? Who opens doors for women anymore? Who gives up their seat to a woman anymore? What group of men clean up their language when a woman walks in the room or becomes in the presence? Oftentimes hers is just as salty and as bad as the men. Who honors motherhood anymore? That the highest calling there is for a woman to be at home and to care for and bring up and rear and raise the next generation instead of farming it out to so-called professionals. And a culture, where is the culture that honors and respects and supports and fosters that view toward motherhood? Now today I see women more exploited than ever to sell everything from hamburgers to cars, everything. Women are exploited, mistreated. There's an inconsiderateness toward women that we just haven't seen in previous years. They're viewed as nothing but objects for somebody's personal self-gratification. And all of this is because of an erosion and a rejecting of the biblical roles of men and women. The Bible teaches a high view of women. So wherever biblical values and principles dominate, women are held in a high value. They're treasured. They're to be cared for. And wherever there's not these biblical values, then women are victimized, they're exploited, and they're ill-treated. See, the man is to support, to care for, to protect, and to nurture women. This, first and foremost, is the father's responsibility. It's the father to the daughter, then the father passes that responsibility to a husband. And then the husband nurtures the wife, and when he has daughters, he nurtures them and then passes that responsibility to the husband. But see, when that support is gone, if that's Something should come to interrupt that support, whether it's death, disease, whatever. The woman is still to be cared for. God has always shown a great concern for widows. Really, for all who are the most vulnerable, our society, the most defenseless, the weak, the exposed, widows, orphans, strangers, the poor. God always expresses this. It's amazing just to see what the Bible teaches concerning widows. Let's just look at a few of those. Psalm 68, 5. Concerning widows. Says, a father of the fatherless and a judge for the widows is God in His holy habitation. In Psalm 146, 9, we're told, that the Lord protects the strangers. He supports the fatherless and the widow. So we see that the widow is under God's special care, under God's special protection. We see that God provides for and made provision for widows, even in the land of Israel. In Deuteronomy 14, verse 29, provision is made through the tithes. It says, and the Levite, because he has no portion or inheritance among you, and the alien, the orphan, and the widow who are in your town, shall come and eat and be satisfied, in order that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hand which you do. So she was to be a sharer of the tithe that was presented to the Levites and to the temple, and to be under the care and protection. In Deuteronomy 24, 19 through 21, we see that she is able, there's the provision for the gleaning. When you reap your harvest in your field, and have forgotten a sheaf in the field, you shall not go back to get it. It shall be for the alien, for the orphan, and for the widow, in order that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. When you beat your olive tree, you shall not go over the boughs again. It shall be for the alien, for the orphan, and for the widow. And when you gather the grapes of your vineyard, you shall not go over it again. It shall be for the alien, for the orphan, and for the widow. See, there's this, God provides through them through established means. He establishes means through which He provides for these widows. We're told in Isaiah chapter 1, verse 17 and 18, that God blesses those who care for and help and honor widows. Learn to do good, seek justice, reprove the ruthless, defend the orphan, plead for the widow. Come now, let us reason together, says the Lord. Though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be white as snow. And you know the rest of the verse. This is not what Israel was doing. They were oppressing widows, orphans, aliens. God promises a blessing on those who help and honor. But again, He also promises punishment on those who mistreat widows, orphans. Over in Exodus 22, verse 22, there in the, this is giving the commandments. You shall not afflict any widow or orphan. If you afflict him at all, and if he does cry out to me, I will surely hear his cry, and my anger will be kindled, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall be widows, and your children fatherless. Listen, you don't want your wife to become a widow. You don't want your children to be orphans. You wouldn't want someone treating your wife this way. You wouldn't want someone treating your children as orphans this way. So treat them the way that I have commanded them to be treated. Jesus showed compassion on the orphans. Remember in Luke chapter 7, the widow of Nain. Jesus encounters this funeral procession, and it's the only son of a widow. See, there's no one to care for her now. What does Jesus do? He raises the son, gives her back. We're told it's because he had compassion on her. Her only means of support was gone, and she sure couldn't trust the Jewish system to take care of her, because what did Jesus indict the Pharisees for doing? They were robbing widows' houses, right? So you compare this concern and care for widows that God has and that God commands and He expresses within the Bible. You compare this with the pagans' world treatment of widows. There are many, many ancient documents, ancient laws that we can go to and see how the pagan world treated widows. In fact, the widowhood was a fate that was feared by most women within the pagan culture that were in the lands of the Bible. You know, a woman could return to her family if her husband died if the purchase price that was paid to the bride's family was returned back to the husband's family, or if the dowry that was paid by the bride's family was returned by the husband's family back to the bride's family. Well, most people weren't willing to do this. They didn't want to part with that. And so the wife had to remain with her husband's family. And often this was just a humiliating circumstance. She was almost less than a slave. And this is, they were usually not allowed to remarry. And this was why many women preferred to die, to be put to death at their husband's burial, rather than to face life without the care and the protection of her husband. This is what it was in the pagan world. But even within Judaism, even within the Old Testament, we see this mistreatment, this exploitation of widows by the nation of Israel. And it was one of the things God harshly condemns them for. But it seems the main hardship that was faced by widows was legal. They lacked legal protection. In fact, they had virtually no rights. We're told, remember over in 2 Kings chapter 4, verse 1, the widow to whom Elijah was sent, to whom he multiplied the oil. In verse 4, it says, "Now a certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets cried out to Elijah, 'Your servant, my husband, is dead, and you know that your servant feared the Lord, and the creditor has come to take my two children to be his slaves.'" So see, widows or children of widows could be sold as slaves in order to pay off any debts of the dead husband. There was just no rights whatsoever. Remember Jesus' parable in Luke 18? The parable of the persistent widow who was coming to the judge over and over and over again. Why is she coming? "Give me legal protection," she's saying. So the main hardship was this legal protection. So Paul's instructions here concerning widows reflect God's special care, God's special concern for widows. There's a high view of women to provide, to protect, to honor. And this is something that the entire church is to fulfill. It's not just something Timothy is to do, but rather the instructions are being given to the entire church through Timothy. Remember James? James 1:27. "This is pure and undefiled religion in the sight of our God and Father, to visit orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself unstained by the world." See, it's the care and the protection and the providing for the widow. But it's not every widow. Not every widow in the church is to receive this. There's a certain group of widows that are. And this is what Paul delineates here in this passage. Verse 3 says, "Honor widows who are widows indeed." Now the word honor, there is going to be this command to honor widows. is influenced by the fifth commandment to honor your father and your mother. In fact, one of the very first ministries of the church seems to have been the care for the widows. Remember over in Acts chapter 6, verse 1, there was this dispute within the church because the widows of the Hellenistic Jews were not receiving as big a portion in the daily serving of meals as Hebrew Jews. A Hellenistic Jew was a Jew who came from a Gentile or Greek background. And so what happens? Well, they appoint men to see that this distribution was done fairly and equitably to all the widows. Remember over in Acts chapter 9 where Peter raises a woman named Tabitha or Dorcas from the dead, Acts chapter 9, verse 36, that she was in Joppa and there was a certain disciple named Tabitha, which translated in Greek is called Dorcas. This woman was abounding with deeds of kindness and charity, which she continually did. And we're told that she died. And all the other widows were weeping and mourning. Well, it seems that this woman's role, all these deeds of charity and kindness that she was doing, she was caring for widows. And so here we have the second account in the Bible of a resurrection done specifically for the benefit of a widow. You have the raising of the widow of Nain and her son by Jesus. Here, the raising of Tabitha and Dorcas, or Tabitha, for the benefit of widows. Now this honor that's to be bestowed, it's not just physical, material well-being, but it's respect. It's to treat them as the weaker vessel, to guard, to protect, to respect, to uphold. Not just materially and physically, but spiritually as well. Now the question is, what's a widow? In our English thinking, in our world, we come to think of a widow as a woman whose husband has died. Well, that's not necessarily the Greek view of a widow. The word kaira just simply means a woman without a husband. It doesn't necessarily mean her husband has died, it just means she's without a husband. Could be she was abandoned by a husband, an ungodly husband. Could be her husband sought a divorce. Remember how easy it was in Judaism for a husband to obtain a divorce? Let's just write a certificate of divorce. She burned the toast. Let's divorce her. She could have been divorced or abandoned by an unbelieving husband when she became a Christian. Perhaps her husband has been imprisoned because of his faith or for whatever reason. Whatever the reason, she is without a husband. She's a woman who's been left alone. We have so many women today who are left alone within our society. Either they've been abandoned by ungodly husbands. Sometimes just age takes its effect. A husband comes down with Alzheimer's or some other debilitating disease. And is essentially leaving the woman alone. It is these believing widows that Paul is talking about. You know, it's interesting that just today, even statistically, divorced women are more likely to live in poverty than divorced men. Followed secondly by widows as opposed to widowers. See, in Paul's day, there was no Social Security. There were no 401k plans. There was no life insurance. There was no pension plans. There was no welfare system. There was no WIC. There was none of that. Economic opportunities just weren't there. And not only that, there was a religious system that was even working against God's commands, right? Remember what Jesus indicted the Pharisees for? Matthew 15:1-6. 1-6, they come to Jesus and saying, "Why do your disciples not wash and violate our laws?" And Jesus says, "Well, why are you violating God's law for the sake of your tradition? You tell somebody that if they dedicated money to the temple, they can't help their mother and father." Therefore, you're violating God's law to honor their father and mother for the sake of your tradition. So they had this whole religious system working against them. So there's a responsibility of the church to care for those without any resources. And these were widows in particular. Remember Jesus' teaching with the widow who comes into the temple? She puts in all that she has. And Jesus points to this as an exploitation of a system that would make a widow have to give her last mite. She should be being cared for by the system, cared for under the Mosaic law, not spending her last penny. So it's the responsibility of the church to care for these. But again, it's not all widows. Only those who are widows indeed. Now Paul here is not denying the widowhood of these others. He's just simply saying and defining those widows who qualify for this care of the church. There are really three types of widows that Paul describes in this passage. There are widows that have family, there are young widows, and then there are widows who are widows indeed. So Paul here begins to sort out who is a widow indeed. He does this in beginning in verse 4. But if any widow has children or grandchildren, let them, that is the children or grandchildren, first learn to practice piety in regard to their own family and to make some return to their parents, for this is acceptable in the sight of God. See, this one does not qualify as a widow indeed. Someone who is with living children or grandchildren, the word children there is technon, it has no relation to age, simply means offspring. If they have living children or grandchildren, they should provide for them. This is what is known in Greek as a first-class conditional clause, the if any widow. In other words, it's assumed true for the sake of argument. It would be highly irregular and very rare that a widow would not have children, that an older widow, someone who is a widow indeed, that is not a younger widow, would not have older children as well. So it's assumed true for the sake of argument. If any widow has children or grandchildren, and we're assuming it's true that she does, then let them first learn to practice piety. Just that little verb has, it's present tense. In other words, as long as she has these children, this is what they should be doing. And they need to learn, again, present tense. They learn by practice, habitually, continuously, constantly. They learn by practice to do these things. Now, if somebody has to learn something, that pretty much tells us right there that what they're having to learn does not come naturally. Otherwise, they wouldn't have to learn it. This Paul told Titus over in Titus chapter 3, verse 14, let our people also learn to engage in good deeds, to meet pressing needs, that they may not be unfruitful. See, they're not the children, grandchildren, they're not to abdicate their responsibility to the church or to anyone or anything else. And again, this has to be learned. It's not natural because it requires selflessness. It requires some self-denial. They have to learn two things, Paul says. They have to learn to practice piety in regard to their own family, piety toward their own family. This is respect, reverence. Again, direct allusion to the fifth commandment. Remember what Paul would say would happen in the latter days? In 2 Timothy 3:2, men will be lovers of self, lovers of money, boastful, arrogant, revilers, disobedient to parents, ungrateful, unholy. Same thing in Romans 1:30, which characterizes a nation of people who have been given over to a reprobate mind. There's no reverence. There's no respect for the parent. There's no love. Again, this is what Pharisees, the Jewish system, was undermining. It was forbidding. And then they made it super spiritual. You've dedicated this to the temple. You can't give it to your parents. Oh, look how more spiritual I am. They've essentially taken a sin and turned it into a virtue, which is happens constantly today. Taking a sin and turning it into a virtue. We've got pastors out there, celebrity preachers, who have fallen into gross immorality and then turned that sin into an object of God's grace, as though their sin magnifies the grace of God. Oh, look how gracious God is, even though I'm such a sinner. They essentially take Romans 6:1, "Shall we continue to sin that grace may increase?" and say, "Yes." No, you just have to practice piety. Again, present tense, habitually, continuously. This is what they are to learn to do, to respect and reverence. Then they are to learn to make some return to their parents. The word literally means that some return is to recompense, to return, to repayment. In other words, they helped you, now you help them. It's an obligation for children to care for their widowed mother or grandmother. And the reason for this is acceptable in the sight of God. There's the motivation, there's the reason for doing it, because it's well-pleasing to God. You're showing the same compassion that God shows toward the widow. The same concern that God has. You're being His instrument to provide for them. And you're acting out of obedience. We see this Jesus with His mother Mary on the cross. He not only provided for her physically by giving her to John and Him taking her into His household. Why did He do that? He had other brothers. Well, because He was also looking out for her spiritually, because her brothers, His brothers were not believers at this time. They didn't become believers till after the resurrection. So He's looking out for her welfare, both physically and spiritually. See this Joseph with Jacob over in Genesis chapter 45. Joseph sins to have his father and family brought in to care for them because he's in a position to do so. So, it honors God. It's acceptable in the sight of God because it honors God. It shows a love for God, a love for His commandment, a love for His Word, a regard for His authority, and a desire to be pleasing to Him, which is the primary motivation. It's not that somebody guilts you into it, but we do this because this is what God commands us to do. There's an old Dutch proverb who says it's easier for one poor parent to bring up 10 children than 10 rich children to care for one poor parent. And so often that is so true today. How often we just see older people just abandon. Just abandon. In nursing homes where they get inadequate care, often abused. It's just sad the way the elderly are treated in our culture today. It used to be age was revered because there was wisdom there and people would seek out the aged. Remember over in Job, just thought of this passage, over in Job, with Elihu, over in verse 32, or chapter 32, In verse 4 it says, now Elihu had wanted to speak to Job because had waited to speak to Job because they, that is these other men, were years older than he. And when Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouth of the three men, his anger burned. So Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite, spoke out and said, I am young in years, and you are old, therefore I was shy and afraid to tell you what I think. I thought age should speak, and increased years should teach wisdom. See, there was this innate respect, this innate deference to those who are more learned. We just don't see that today. Instead, they're obsolete. They're shuffled to the side. We don't treasure the aged. In fact, they're considered a burden. It's the same thing with children. They have such warped sense of value. You know, the average size of the family in the early 1900s was 8 children. That was the average size. Well, in the agrarian society, the more kids you had, the better off you were. Children were viewed as an asset. Today, it's, how much is this kid going to cost me? You know, children are not viewed as an asset. They're viewed as a liability. Something that may infringe on our freedom and lifestyle. So no, he's telling him, listen, you got to learn this. You learn this piety. You learn this respect. You learn to be self-sacrificial and to make return to your parents. Because this is acceptable. This is what brings glory and honor to God. And then in verse 5, he defines the widow indeed. Now she who is a widow indeed, because the one who still has living children is not, and the church should not be supporting them. But she who is a widow indeed and has been left alone, see, there's a definition. It's this concept of her being left alone goes way beyond just her not having any living relatives, any living children. But she's left alone in the sense that she also has no intention to remarry. She has made a conscious decision not to seek to be remarried. She has been left alone. Perfect tense. An action that occurred in the past that continues up to the present. That word left alone, it's the only time it's used in the New Testament. It means solitary, forsaken, or desolate. This is the way she has been left in the past, and she still is that way. This is a widow indeed. And she, rather than fixing her hope on another marriage or some other means of support, what has she done? She has fixed her hope on God. Again, perfect tense. An action that occurred in the past, it continues to the present. She fixed her hope on God in the past when she became a widow, and her hope is still on God. Continues to be. Not a remarriage, not other means of support, but God. This is a widow indeed. And continues, again, present tense, habitual, constantly, continues in. That word continues, prosmeno, there's an intensity to it. Meno just simply means to abide and remain. And when you add a preposition to the beginning of a Greek word, you intensify the meaning of it. This is prosmeno, to or toward abiding. There's an intensity there. This means she remains, she's holding fast to, she's cleaving to this. This is her hope, nothing else. This. And so she continues in entreaties and prayers night and day. What's the difference between entreaties and a prayer? An entreaty, it's a petition. particularly petition out of need. It's the ask, seek, knock. It's the widow pounding and going to the judge over and over. That's the entreaty. It's the widow of Luke 18:3. Typically, it's dealing with a concrete situation, a specific desire, a specific request. It's the word used over in Romans 10:1 for Paul's prayer for his Jewish brethren. Brethren, my heart's desire and my prayer, my entreaty to God for them is for their salvation. See, there's a specific request, and it's done with urgency. Often takes the form of intercession. So this is what she is doing, holding fast to, intensely, calling on God, entreating Him, calling on His promises. So she continues in these end prayers. It's just a synonym of entreaty, but deals more, just more with the fact of prayer than the content. This is what she's doing. She is calling on God. And her calling on God takes the form of entreaties. Her hope in God is manifested in her intense devotion to prayer. She's doing this night and day. Not all night and all day. The words there in genitives form. Rather, it's by night, by day. Says Paul, said over in 1 Thessalonians 3:10, speaking of his prayer for the Thessalonians, as he says, as we night and day keep praying most earnestly that we may see your face and may complete what is lacking in your faith. In other words, it's not just a flippant little prayer thrown up to God. This is something that occupies a portion of her day, a portion of her night, every day. Now, an example of this in the Old Testament that we have is probably Anna over in Luke chapter 2. Remember, Anna was in the temple who saw Jesus as he was being taken into the temple to be circumcised. We're told in verse 36, there was a prophetess, Anna, the daughter of Phanuel, the tribe of Asher. She was advanced in years, having lived with a husband 7 years after her marriage, then is a widow to the age of 84. And she never left the temple serving night and day with fastings and prayers. See, she devoted herself to the work of God. She has fixed her hope on God. This is a woman who seeks first the kingdom of God and lets God handle the rest. She devoted her life to the service of the church, service of others, to prayer. It's kind of what Paul talks about over in 1 Corinthians in chapter 7 in his instructions for marriage in chapter 7, but he concludes chapter 7, verse 39 and 40. A wife is bound as long as her husband lives. But if her husband is dead, she is free to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. But in my opinion, she's happier if she remains as she is. And I think that I also have the Spirit of God. You're better off to do this, to devote your life to the service of the Lord and entrust your care to God. So this is the widow indeed. This is the one who is the widow indeed. And it's a striking contrast to the widow in verse 6. But she who gives herself to wanton pleasure is dead even while she lives. See, the widow indeed has given herself to God. What's this widow given herself to? Wanton pleasure. The word is used only 2 times in the New Testament. Here and in James chapter 5:5, where James is describing the wickedness. You have lived luxuriously, there's that word. You have lived luxuriously on the earth and led a life of wanton pleasure. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. See, it's this self-centered, self-focused life. The word is used one time in the New in the Old Testament in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, Ezekiel 16:49. Again, in a condemnatory way. Behold, this was the guilt of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters had arrogance, abundant food, and careless ease. But she did not help the poor and needy. See, it was just a self-focused life. Two things describe this widow. It's what she lives for and her spiritual condition. What is she living for? Want and pleasure. She gives herself to want and pleasure. It's a wholehearted giving over to it. The self-indulgent, self-centered life. Perhaps this widow received a large inheritance from a husband. Perhaps she was involved in the church while her husband was alive. But now that he's gone, it's just a life of self-gratification. This is exactly what Paul tells Timothy to instruct others to avoid over in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 17. Instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God. Who did the widow indeed set her hope on? God. Who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. Instruct them to do good, to be rich in good works, and to be generous and ready to share, storing up for themselves the treasure of a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is life indeed. See, this is what this woman should have been doing. The widow indeed lives for God. This widow lives for herself with no care for anyone else but her want and pleasure. That's what she lives for. And her spiritual condition is she's dead. She might be alive physically, but she's dead spiritually. She's of the world. She loves the world. This widow is essentially the female counterpart of the rich man in Jesus' parable, Luke 16, of the rich man Lazarus. Here you have Lazarus laying at the gate, full of sores, dogs licking his wound, and the rich man is in there living luxuriously, no thought to anything going on outside. You know, what's interesting is about that parable is that there's no evil really attributed to this man. He's not out engaging in a lot of evil activity. He's not condemned for any way in which he had gotten his wealth. He's eating voluptuously, but he could afford to do it. That was fine. There was nothing wrong. He lived in a palatial house. That's fine. He could afford it. There's no condemning him as a wicked person in terms of his lifestyle. But it's his absolute disregard for others over the pleasing of his own want and pleasure. See, this widow had all the world could offer, but she lost her soul. She lost her soul. Her heart and her mind is set on this world, not on things above. And so, for the sake of momentary pleasure, for the sake of her want and pleasure, something that's here today, gone tomorrow, she has to go find something else to top what she did before. She's lost her eternal joy, her heavenly happiness. It's interesting, just as you study the monarchs of Europe and you see the palatial wealth and the power that they had and all the privileges they had, how many of them were just miserable people? Miserable. The sin of self, selfishness, self-gratification, self-indulgence, it's ruinous. It's ruinous to the soul. What's sad is that it's this appeal to self and self-gratification and self-interest that characterizes most church growth today, doesn't it? It's this pandering to the flesh, appealing to personal interests, to certain demographics. This is deadly. Great 18th, 19th century pastor J.C. Ryle wrote in his book Practical Religion, he said, "I believe this," and that is talking about the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, said, "I believe this is meant to teach us to beware of living only for ourselves. It is not enough that we're able to say, I live a moral and respectable life. I pay everyone his due. I discharge all the relations of life with propriety. I attend church. I read the Bible. I pray to God." This still leaves another question to which the Bible requires an answer. To whom do you live? To yourself or to Christ? What is the great end, aim, object, and ruling motive in your life? Let men call the question extreme if they please. For myself, I can find nothing short of this in Paul's words. He died for all that those who live should no longer live for themselves, but for Him who died for them and rose again. And I come to the conclusion that if, like the rich man, we live only for ourselves, we shall destroy our souls. And this is precisely what this widow does. She's destroyed her soul. She's dead while she lives. This is not someone the church should be supporting. In fact, to support would be simply to aid and abet her sinful lifestyle and her self-centered, self-indulgent life. And that's, a Christian or church should never aid and abet a sinful life. Never. Then Paul, again, gives Timothy this charge. Prescribe these things as well. Remember, he just told him over in verse 11 of chapter 4, prescribe and teach these things. And we saw then how strong that word prescribe is. It's literally command. This is an authoritative instruction. This is not something that's just a suggestion. Timothy has to come in to this church and do a lot of correcting. And so he has to authoritatively prescribe these things. Now just imagine. Here's a church, Ephesus, where strange doctrines have been introduced, strange teachings have been going on. Timothy has to come in and correct all those. And on top of that, he has to correct the way the church has been dealing with some of their widows. This may mean that the church will no longer support a widow of maybe the most generous giver in the church. Or will no longer be supporting the mother of one of the most influential people in the church. He's going to have to be calling on people within the church to step up and assume their responsibility for caring for their widow parent instead of foisting it on the church. Can you imagine the trouble this is going to cause within the church? Can you imagine the Facebook posts that are going to start flying around out there about how mean and cruel and uncaring and harsh this pastor is? Timothy has to do it. He has to prescribe these things as well. That is, besides all the other stuff he's just been told to prescribe and teach. Why? So that they may be above reproach. See, it's out of love for the flock. Out of love for the flock, for the good of the flock. But notice, there's a hint of uncertainty there. So that they may be above reproach. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. If they comply, they will. Otherwise, they're going to be guilty of violating the fifth commandment. They're going to be blameworthy. And if it's habitual, they're not a believer. As verse 8 spells out, if anyone does not provide for his own, especially those of his household, he's denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. Which we'll get into more next week. See, church shows the love of Christ. But it doesn't just do so indiscriminately. That's poor stewardship. It has to distribute. And it shows the love of Christ and helps and aids those who are deserving. But there has to be a process to determine whether someone is deserving. And not just done indiscriminately. Otherwise, you're going to be aiding and abetting somebody's sinful life. Remember when I was in South Carolina, there was a person in the church who was renting a house. Actually, a leader in the church, elder, renting a house to an unmarried couple. Well, he personally is aiding and abetting this people's sinful lifestyle in doing that. Well, the house burned down, and he wanted to take up a collection from the whole church for this couple. Of course, I had to be the bad guy and say, no, that's not something we're going to do. Why? Because now you're trying to involve the entire church in aiding and abetting these people's sinful lifestyle. That's not showing the love of Christ. The church shows the love of Christ to those who are deserving, and it refuses to support and indulge sinful behavior. And when it does, then it will be above reproach. Maybe not man's reproach. Probably get all sorts of accusations of being heartless and unkind. You never avoid man's reproach when you act biblically. But that's not the reproach we want to be above. We want to be above the reproach of God. And this is how Timothy can be above the reproach of God, is to prescribe, authoritatively prescribe, command these things. Make sure the church is acting biblically in its care of the widows in their midst. And this is something the church needs to learn today. So much of the activity of the church today aids and abets sinful activity, selfishness. It actually uses, panders to people's selfishness and self-centeredness. It's in all in the means of church growth. You're not above reproach. Paul is to lead the church in such a way, Timothy is to lead the church in such a way, which they'd be above reproach. And that is what we want to do and what our goal should be. As believers and as a body. Let's pray.